Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti and I thank you for joining us. As you may have noticed, I am flying solo today. Natalie Sawyer isn't with us, probably because Brentford lost while Dean Smith's Villa won, so she needs to get a bit of time to recover. But to make up for this, we have not one, but two guests in the studio. We've got Mr. Gary Jacob.
Morning, Gabs.
And The Times resident stats man. Actually, You're the Times' chief stats officer, yeah?
It's got to be different every week.
There you go. Bill Edgar. And down the line from the lovely hamlet of Kharkiv, it's Paul Hurst. Later on, we'll be looking at the bottom of the table with the nightmare at Newcastle and the failings at Fulham. That's a clever alliteration there, isn't it? But we start with the return of Cristiano Ronaldo to Old Trafford. So we start this segment on Ronaldo's return by going in a slightly different direction. Lucy Holden has written this piece, which features prominently in the game. And Lucy, you didn't write the headline. It sums up the dilemma at the center of your piece. The headline is, what do you do when the man you idolize is accused of rape? And you obviously, you went to Madeira, where Cristiano Ronaldo's from, home to the Cristiano Ronaldo Museum, the Cristiano Ronaldo Hotel, and so on, as well as Turin. And you spoke to people about how they felt. And the sense I got from reading it was that for many, there seems to be a real sense of confusion.
First of all, we should say that Ronaldo has denied all allegations made against him. Madeira, if you haven't been, is a shrine to Ronaldo, who, as you said, grew up there. Everything is about him. You can't walk for a mile on the island without seeing a huge bronze statue of him. You know, the one at the airport has been very covered before because it looked nothing like him. But he's on the back of buses in adverts. His huge face covers walls in the form of murals. You can't escape him. Madeira is branded around Ronaldo, so to admit that he might have done something as horrific as a sexual attack would mean that they'd have to change everything about the island and about themselves, really.
One of the key points here, I think it comes through in some of the people you talk to. You make the analogy with the Pope. It's a public figure who is incredibly adored and who you feel an allegiance to. He's only been accused. He hasn't been charged. Does it seem natural that while people would obviously be tremendously disturbed by the allegations, they would still be inclined to give him the benefit of the doubt, the way one might with a family member or a close friend who's accused of this?
Yes. I mean, really, that sums it up, because he is, by everyone on Madeira, thought of as a friend. His family still lives there. His brother runs the museum, Ugo, who we spoke to. His mother, Dolores, lives in a house there. His sister runs the shop there, the CR7 shop. Everybody knows the family. It's that small an island. So really, to accuse Ronaldo of rape on the island is to accuse a friend of rape. And therefore, they are siding with him. I saw the same in Turin, where he was playing for Juventus on Saturday. Somebody said to me, a woman there who's been a Juventus fan since she was a baby, having grown up there, she said, he's too big to fail. That's really the opinion. You know, he can't. How can he? They've paid this much money, 88 million, I think, for him. And for it all to go wrong now would be just too devastating for them.
Yeah, it's interesting because what comes through quite clearly is the differences in the reaction between Madeira, where, you know, he's got this, he's from there, he's part of them.
Yeah.
And Juventus, where, you know, he rocked up 3 months ago, and it kind of feels that, and I thought this was actually kind of disappointing, in a lot of the quotes, it seemed that, oh, but he's been so good. He's such a talented, he makes the people around him better. I mean, Juventus's press office tweeted something to that effect, which I found completely idiotic and distasteful, because he's not being accused of being a poor footballer. But I found it disappointing that some of the people, that was their reaction. Like, I kind of empathize with the reaction in Madeira much more than that in Turin, if that makes any sense.
Yes, no, it does. And I think basically it's a form of blocking. Turin went crazy when he joined them. He's been reported to have moved there to try and speed up training with his new team. He's been seen eating out in the city, walking around. The local glossy magazine describes the reaction as delirium. They couldn't have rolled out a bigger red carpet for his arrival, so they didn't know what to do. They'd walked themselves into a corner, really. They couldn't then backtrack. I was told it took the local papers 5 days to cover the story. And really what you said there about people's reaction in talking about his skill, that to me was just evidence of a tackle of the question, really, a complete block. So many people in Madeira too actually said to me, he's so good. There was this desire to try to separate his talent with his personality and behavior in his personal life, which is completely irrelevant.
And we have to stress again, obviously, he has not been charged. Hirsty, you're not in Manchester now, but you were before. You've written about Cristiano's early days at Old Trafford. It's all been very well chronicled. What sort of reaction do you expect in midweek? I'm told United have toned things down a little bit, also because it's not the first time, of course, he comes back to Old Trafford since leaving. What's the general sense in Manchester?
Well, again, the last time, like you say, it's not the first time he's been back to Old Trafford. He went back with Real Madrid. And I remember then when the names were read out on the team sheet, the public address left Ronaldo's name for the last one, and he shouted his name aloud and he said, "Welcome back to Old Trafford, Cristiano Ronaldo," and everyone went absolutely mental in terms of like supporting him. But you know, he probably will be a little bit more subdued this time, I would have thought. He does kind of cast a cloud over him, doesn't he, and over his kind of returns. It does put you in a, you know, a bit of a dilemma, I guess, if you're attending that game. If you're a United fan going to that match, you know, you kind of think, oh yeah, he did a great player for us. You know, he's still a great player now, but what if he is guilty of this, you know, awful crime? That must be hanging in the back of your mind. So yeah, I think it will be a bit more subdued this week, yes.
You sort of reconstructed anecdotes and stories from when he arrived at Old Trafford. Some of them are familiar to us, some of them were not. He really was like a very image-obsessed big kid, right? When he was there, I'm thinking of the teeth whitening incident with Quentin Fortune.
Yes, that's right. He was, you know, incredibly obsessed with his looks. Quentin Fortune, he talks about on one occasion, there was a mirror brought into the United dressing room, and Ronaldo insisted on having this mirror next to his locker, Fortune says, so he could look at himself and, you know, just remind himself how good looking he was. So, you know, check himself out now and again. And, you know, that sort of encapsulates him. He wanted to be the best at everything. He wanted to be the best footballer. He wanted to have the best body. He wanted to have the best hairstyle. He wanted to look the best. He wanted his image to be the best. And that was, you know, that he was so driven to achieve that during his time in the United that he literally went round telling everyone that, you know, I want to be the best. I will be the best. And in fact, he said that when he went into the changing room for the first time at Carrington And, you know, that's quite a big call. You've got some front to do that when you consider that, you know, in that changing room already, you've got, you know, Ruud van Nistelrooy, you have Roy Keane, Ryan Giggs, Paul Scholes. So, you know, that's what, having spoken to some of these old coaches at United this week and former teammates, that's the one impression that came across most, that he was so kind of confident, and that really kind of shook everyone from the first moment they met him. But obviously, a lot of people say that, and he's actually gone on to back it up.
So you can read Paul's piece from 5 o'clock on Monday, 5 o'clock UK time. We'll get back to the game. Obviously, we can't ignore what happened at the weekend. 2-2 at Chelsea. Let's start at the end and get this over with in our Monday Mourinho podcast. I want to get your views, guys, on what happened at the very end with Chelsea getting that late equalizer through Ross Barkley. I wasn't sure it was him, but that I saw him and I recognized him. Most people didn't. Some people called him the Masseur. No, it's a guy named Marco Yanni, who's one of Sadi's assistants. He's sort of his tactical guy. He runs across the United bench. He runs in front of the United bench from the pictures we saw, turns, celebrates in front of Mourinho, and then runs back the other way. Although I didn't actually see any pictures of him running back. And it was at this point when he runs back that, you know, you see sort of Mourinho staring straight ahead, and all of a sudden his eyes light up and he runs after him, and there's a melee. Gary, he obviously broke some sort of code, right? Marco Yanni, where you don't celebrate to humiliate your opponents, and so therefore, as a manager, you're justified in jumping up out of your chair and going after him physically. Is that the ex-pro argument?
There's an etiquette, isn't there, on the technical areas, not to do things like this, provocative. And
do you have any clever theory about why Mourinho waited for him? He did something on the way back.
No,
but we don't have pictures of that, do we?
No, well, there was a one picture of him coming back, and it looked like he may well have said something, because I'm not sure that Mourinho would have worked out it was him who would have.
All these Italians look alike.
No,
you know?
No.
Plus the people on the bench are wearing the same clothes.
No, because there was, if you look at it, there was a lot of bedlam in front,
right.
Wasn't it?
So he might not have noticed him the first time.
He may have just seen the water coming that way.
Right.
He may not have realised who it was. So when he comes back, it looks like, when you see the one image of it, it looks like he potentially may have said something.
Okay.
Because that's the way Mourinho reacts, as if, right, okay, you said something and I'll react to that. Do you disagree, or?
Yeah, we either said something or made a rude gesture or something. I mean, Mourinho could clear it up straight away, of course, but he didn't. He felt Marco Yanni had apologised, and he thought, oh, maybe I'll just let it lie now. And secondly, he's done so many terrible things. He doesn't want to kind of it to rumble on, and all the papers, they list 50 terrible things that Mourinho have done.
Okay, but can we not show Mourinho some love here?
Pardon?
Can we not show Mourinho some love?
Yeah, I think it would be, I mean, it's sort of understandable if you saw the way that Yanni celebrated in front of him, and then at the very least kind of celebrated for staring at him at close range, you know, 5-10 seconds later after the
Gary's
dust
staring
had settled.
At me, should I get up and go after him?
No, I think that when people make the argument that if you're a manager you can't react to these situations, I mean, that's quite a difficult thing to do in this circumstance. He's at his former club. It's the 96th minute. It's an equaliser with 30 seconds to go. Crowd are on him. There's a lot of factors. He's had a difficult time for the last 2 months with his future. So when you put all of those into the thing, it only requires one little thing to set him off. And I suppose since Mourinho's left, he's made quite a few digs. It's not the first time he's shown the three fingers, is it, as well?
No.
So he's probably made quite a few digs. But the one thing I'll say about Chelsea fans is that, like all supporters, they're quite fickle. And 3 years down the line, if Mourinho's available and they're in a difficult sweat, suddenly the rose-tinted glasses
come in. Sergio Ramos argument, right?
Yeah.
If Sergio Ramos were English, y'all would love him, right?
Yeah.
Holding up three fingers, all it tells me is that you were a successful manager who won things here. But the premise of that is we should respect you more because you were successful than we should go and respect, I don't know, Andre Villas-Boas or Rafa Benitez, who was less successful when he was there. What's the basis of that? We respect people who are successful, and we disrespect. But it's okay to disrespect people who stink at their job. I mean, is this the argument?
The problem is he's made quite a few digs, hasn't he, since he's left, and the digs get under people's skin, and therefore he gets it chucked back in his face.
let's move on to another United, Newcastle. They have somehow now lost their first five home games of the season following their defeat to Brighton on Saturday. George Culkin, he writes, "This is a club flawed from the top down, incapable of putting two good decisions together, with a rich history of bafflement and failure. The manager has tried to change it to the point of exhaustion." He says blaming Rafa Benitez would be like blaming the iceberg for being in the way of the Titanic. I'm going to ask you, as somebody who's from London, do you share the pain of Newcastle? Do you get this? Or are you kind of like baffled and say, like, why isn't this like any other club that makes bad decisions? Or are you swooped up in this Culkin-esque narrative?
No, I'm not. No.
No, you don't care. You don't care.
No. Well, I think I've got sympathy in terms of, obviously, Rafa, they sold players in the summer and they made a profit, and so effectively he's relatively under strength compared to last season, while clubs like Fulham are spending 100 million, West Ham spending
100 million. On the profit front, they made a profit.
Small one.
Because they sold Mikel Merino, who had his ups and downs last season and clearly wasn't part of Rafa's plans anymore. They sold Chancel and Bemba, big loss there. And of course, they sold Mitrovic for a ton of money, but again, he wasn't there, right?
Yeah. But when you look at the squad, it's a better squad than perhaps their position in the table. Who has the worst squad? Huddersfield.
Yeah.
Cardiff.
Yeah. Those are the two that jump out at you.
Brighton.
Yeah, probably. Brighton. But Brighton are a team.
Charlie, the producer, suggests Burnley have a worse squad.
I saw Burnley against Wolves, and they've certainly got problems. Yeah, I'd say that. Yeah.
I think Newcastle have got individually quite a decent midfield. Diarmé, good ball winner. Shelby. Fine long passer. Richie and Kennedy, kind of decent, creative types. So they shouldn't be at the bottom, certainly. But
are you going to blame Rafa, or is that like...
A little bit. I guess blame the owner most. I mean, Newcastle have got long-term problems. For a club that's consistently in the top 10 attendances throughout history, not to have won the league since 1927, there's some sort of long-term issue. They've only been in the top three, four times since then. It should have been much, much more. You can look at the last 10 years and say Ashley's messed up commercially. They've not improved at all in terms of their commercial income, whereas other clubs have leapt forward, so they should have a lot more money. But even on the wage bill, as I understand it, they should be a lot higher.
Yeah,
they had the eighth highest wage bill in the country when they were in the Championship, for example.
I mean, the argument in favour of Rafa is obviously that, you know, he's won lots of things, blah, blah, blah. So it can't necessarily be his fault because he's proved himself to be a good manager. But you would probably expect to be doing better than they are. What has he got, 2 points? The whole club, it looks unhealthy from the outside, looking at it from down here. From the top down, it just looks unhealthy wherever you go. You've got... Probably Rafa's looking for his next job, and maybe has been since the summer when West Ham were available. They're now looking for potential change. He's looking for where else he can go. It's just not a healthy situation, is it, really? It's sort of, it's no one really, it's like he doesn't want to be there. They're not sure about him. So.
But you don't care, you said.
I care because I've got friends in Newcastle. George.
No, I was wondering, though, if to what degree the...
I think sometimes the... Perhaps it's different to London, where there's so many clubs. Over there, it's a completely different area, and people get sucked up into everything. So you're slightly different in London. You're a lot more impartial to some of the clubs.
But I wonder, though, to what degree the aura of the club... You know, it certainly influences how we view the story, because Newcastle, I think, undeniably have an aura about them in the same way Leeds United did. And when Leeds was ruined by certain people, I think some of us felt English football was losing something, right? Do we feel the same way seeing Newcastle in the state? Or is that a myth because then people mention like the 70s and stuff like that, and those long periods when Newcastle kind of perpetually underachieved relative to their attendances?
Yeah, you would like to. I mean, ups and downs in football, all part of the story. It's fine for big clubs to, you know, have spells in the lower division. It's a nice story,
Like 10 years, more than that.
Yeah, I think they would be.
Would you miss Newcastle if they went the way of Leeds?
Yeah, I think it would, probably people would welcome Leeds back.
Yeah, but they came straight back up.
But Newcastle, I mean, you're missing them from the top six, you know, from actually trying to win a trophy. You know, they're a long way from that.
What's your view on Newcastle, Gabs?
I think when you have an owner who's clearly not interested and not committed, it creates an enormous negative vibe around the club. I think the romance of Newcastle also impacts the way we view them. I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing, because they are part of, for whatever reason, they are part of the narrative of English football, and in the way many other clubs are not. By the same token, I think, you know, if you caught Rafa in an honest moment, you'd go back and say, like, there were certain things that, you know, we could have done differently or we could have done better. That whole Mitrovic affair was just odd to me. And obviously the Dwight Gayle, you know, again, hindsight being 20/20, you know, maybe not the cleverest thing. But yeah, I think clearly the players are better than their league position. Yeah, but easily Rafa's got a tough job ahead.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no,
yes.
How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Let's move on to another manager who, unlike Rafa, his club were one of the five biggest spending teams in Europe in net terms. Fulham. They lost to Cardiff. Some people are suggesting Djokanovic might be replaced at some point. Gary, I'm going to go to you because you're also our transfer guru. They signed 27 players in the summer. I certainly felt that way. They signed a lot. It seemed like a lot of them, I thought, like, oh, these are potential, you know, value signings. Like, we knew Vieto was really, really highly rated a few years ago. Yeah, bring him in. He's obviously talented. Schürrle, same thing, right? The guy, you know, was in World Cup final and stuff. And you get all these guys, the dude they got from Marseille, whose name escapes me right now.
Anguissa,
you know, highly rated.
Yeah, he's got ability.
But you bring so many in one go when the pieces don't fit together, and what's going on? Can you explain? What's the strategy? I mean, is there a director of football? Is it Tony Khan who's the director of football? Or
in effect, yeah.
So what were they trying to do?
Clearly, they didn't feel their squad was good enough for the Premier League.
So they just went out and bought a new one?
Well, perhaps they veered too much the other way and bought too many new faces in. But if you look at it, when you look at the signings, they didn't really strengthen properly in defence. You got Mawson, Chambers, who's not brilliant.
Well, strengthen in defence. I mean, no, Mawson was in England. He's an England squad player, right?
England squad player.
And what's his name? Callum Chambers, right? He's got the pedigree, Arsenal. He has a bunch of England caps. I mean, you could see the logic in saying,
no,
let's get this guy and relaunch his career. Or what, is Chambers just bad forever?
I couldn't see any logic in Chambers at all.
You see the logic when Arsenal signed him?
I think Wenger signed him on one game, which is Southampton against Arsenal, where Chambers, from memory, might have played at right back. The word is when Wenger turned up Southampton to buy, they assumed he was going to buy Schneiderlin, and then he said, I'll have Chambers, and Southampton were like mystified by the whole thing. So
he was only 18 then, wasn't he? So
yeah.
He was bought on potential.
And frankly, judging Wenger on trying to sign a defender is a terrible...
But Chambers also got a bunch of under-21 caps. I'm pretty sure he played for England as well in one of those cheapo things. Is Chambers just some colossal fraud? Is this what he is? Is he a con artist? I don't understand. No,
he showed signs of improvement towards the end of last season when he came on for Koscielny in the semi-final against Madrid, and he looked like he was showing signs of improvement. But the problem with it, he goes on these loans and going somewhere like Fulham where there's no protection in front of him. He's going to get exposed quite often, and that's no good for him as a learning curve. if you look at Jokanović this season, looking at stats, 6 different centre-back partnerships. He doesn't know what his best team is. He doesn't know the best lineup, the substitutions.
Who are his best centre-backs?
Good question. I don't know.
What do you think?
Dennis Adoy was the main guy.
Mawson and one other,
last
probably.
Dennis Adoy and Tim Ream were the main guys last year.
Maybe
they brought in 5 new defenders. I mean, they also, we haven't mentioned, Fosu-Mensah, Joe Bryan, and Le Marchand as well. But he's just been chopping and changing so much. And Adoy has played right back and centre back. Chambers has played both. There's been so much change that it's hard to, there's no settled pattern at all. There's very little protection for them. And going forward, they've been fine. I think, Schürrle, Vieta have been fine. You mentioned earlier, Mitrovic, obviously, Seri's looked good. So they're just far too open. I look back to the season when they were relegated, 2013-14, they used 39 players, which was the most by any top flight team in one season since 1919-20. And they're carrying on in the same kind of haphazard vein. They're heading down at the moment.
And to go back into similarity with Newcastle, where you got Rafa going into last year's contract, not taking a new contract, perhaps looking elsewhere. Jokanović, he brings the team up. You'd expect the first thing he would do is to sign a new contract and say, yeah, I'm committed to the club. The club are committed to me. He has talks. He turns down the offer because perhaps he thinks he might get something better.
Turn down the offer? Or was he given the sort of offer that they would have expected him to turn down?
That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that.
Because I've been led to believe.
I think both sides clearly aren't enamoured with each other. But that's not a healthy state, is it, for a guy who's brought you up? You would expect.
It's not ideal, but by the same token, these guys are professionals, right? I mean, I appreciate. Jokanović might feel better about himself. He's like, yes, I have a Pochettino contract. The club believe in me. It's great. And I'm making more money. And so I come to work with a smile on my face. But the reality is, Slavisa, you're managing a Premier League side. You should be coming to work with a smile on your face every day because there are a bazillion people out there who would love to have your job. And even if, and you can turn the fact that you didn't necessarily commit into a positive, because it means that if you keep Fulham up and with all these talented players they gave you, they looked kind of like a mid-table team, right? Potentially in terms of talent, right? You do that, and you're not bound by a contract. You can go and move up to a bigger club next year, right? So I don't buy this as an excuse for. I like Jokanović a lot. I like them as a player, actually, when he come on for those last few minutes. This could have worked to his advantage, right? It doesn't necessarily have to be this right.
I suspect that was part of his thinking as well when he didn't sign it. That he would have been in a strong position that if he did well. But it's a strange situation to have that with a manager going to, Wenger had it, what's going on with your contract? That's a very strange situation around the club. But the only time I've seen Fulham live this season was against Tottenham, and they just looked remarkably open. And it was a game where they lost 3-1. They could have lost 7-1. So, there were too many chances. And you can't, at the top level, you can't do that. I mean, you've probably seen them, haven't you, Gabs?
Yes, I have. And it looks like a team that's not really been coached, actually. And that's what I found disappointing with Jokanović. Time now to find out how Natalie and I got on in our weekly predictions game. The two of us are tied across the season as a whole. As you know, after taking a wide lead, I decided to go and let Natalie get back into it. No, I didn't. Natalie's done really well. In the Bundesliga, we both expected Bayern struggles to continue and predicted a draw at Wolfsburg. We were wrong. Bayern got back to winning ways, despite Arjen Robben getting sent off. Probably something to do with the absolute riot act that Uli Hoeneß and Karl-Heinz Rummenigge read the German media on Friday. We also thought it would be more misery for Mourinho and predicted Chelsea win at Stamford Bridge. And while it no doubt felt like a defeat for Mourinho, it was, of course, a draw. We both had Everton beating Palace on Sunday, so that's good. Here's where we were different. Natalie backed Bournemouth to beat Southampton, but I correctly went for the draw because I believe in Sparky. However, in the Championship, I predicted defeat for Dean Smith in his first game in charge of Villa, but Natalie was right in calling a Villa win over Swansea, which means that this week is actually a draw between Natalie and myself. No winners, so we're still level, 4-4 across the season as a whole. The deadlock cannot be broken, or at least until next week. All right, enough of this. How about some quick hits? Manchester City beat up Burnley 5-0, but Sean Dyche is annoyed, and rightly so. Yes, I'm with the big ginger one on this point. First, Vincent Kompany escapes a red, and then City score a goal after the ball appeared to go out of play. Then Sané kicks out Matty Loughton while he's walking by. How is this not a red, like, and possibly a criminal charge? Bill, you have sympathy, right? Hey, again, I don't want to go on about the referees and VAR or even question the fact that City are a much better team and deserve to win. But if you're Sean Dyche, you're kind of like, what the hell? These guys are professionals. This is really, really bad, right?
Yeah, a company you could certainly argue should have been sent off for dangerous play. Probably not malicious. He was just too late. Lennon got in very quickly and he was too late. But I mean, company is getting caught out for pace now and again. And of course, it was the first minute, so people tend to get sent off early on, which is obviously wrong. Did the ball go out of play? I watched it 100 times. Couldn't be sure if I had to put my life on it. I'd say it probably didn't. There was a tiny bit of the ball maybe over the line, but you'd need byline technology. As we see, goal line technology is you're absolutely clear.
You just need an assistant referee who's in line with it, and had he been there, he would have noticed that the ball went out of play.
Well, I couldn't. I've
you
seen.
You can't possibly be in line, can you?
You can't. But there's a post in the way.
It's just a post or a player in a way, and then you're at an angle. And
the post is in line with the white line, right? So if you see the ball on the other side of the post, it's gone out of play.
It could have gone out of play, and you still don't see it. So, but from the TV, you couldn't tell. So
and Sané? What's your excuse for Sané?
Whatever.
Annoys me. Liverpool get 3 points at Huddersfield as Jurgen Klopp gets one over on his old mate, David Wagner. Gary, this performance, though, was nothing to write home about, was it?
No.
Or do you subscribe to the notion whereby winning while not firing in all cylinders is a sign of strength?
Bill will probably know the stats better than I, but I kind of think that's a bit of a worn cliche.
Mm-hmm.
That the idea when you're not playing well, and in fact, Pochettino was asked that on Saturday, when you're not playing well, does it mean it's a sign of this? But I think when you look at it, it applies to certain teams over the years, but there are other factors chucked into that make that stand up. And I don't believe that cliche. But, you know, it was only a few weeks ago, Liverpool wonderful against Tottenham. So,
and then bad against Napoli. Everton leave it late, but eventually dispatch Crystal Palace 2-0 with a big help from their substitutes and from Jordan Pickford, who saves a penalty. Bill, your choice. Would you rather praise Marco Silva for his 3 wins on the bounce, or share your worries over Roy Hodgson, whose Palace side have taken 1 point from the last 4?
I'm not too worried about Palace at the moment, really. I don't think they'll be anywhere near the relegation zone at the end of the season. Everton, I think there's a pleasing style. They're better to watch than they were last season. And Jordan Pickford, a great save. He had 2 options covered. He dived to the left, so he might well have stopped it if the ball had gone that way. But he also had the presence of mind to keep a firm leg dangling in the centre of goal in case the ball was hit in that direction. And as it was, and he saved it well. I think it showed a goalkeeper in top physical condition and with an alert mind.
And if you watch his Match of the Day 2 interview, he also seems like a pretty likable guy. Spurs are still severely under strength, but nevertheless, they edged West Ham 1-0. Gary, did they deserve the 3 points? And you wrote about Eric Lamela today. Can he fill the gap?
They deserve the 3 points. West Ham didn't really create any intensity in the game at all. And Spurs did the job.
Tell me about Lamela. Come on, get me excited. I want Lamela to be the guy we thought he could be 5 years ago.
Yeah, but...
But
this is interesting, Gabs, isn't it? Because he got 15 goals in his last year at Roma. But ever since then, he's never... Is he a different player to then? He looks, to me, from the outside, a completely different player. 15 goals in Italy is a lot of goals. So tell me, was he completely different at Roma? Did he play more advanced? Was he a better finisher?
He had a really bad injury, too, in the middle of it, don't forget.
Yeah, but that was in his third season at Spurs, or fourth?
I think it was his second season, actually.
No.
He got injured in his first season, too, but not
yeah,
as long.
Yeah, he did, yeah. So, but tell me, is there a guy who can actually get 15 goals? Or
look, I mean, I think we sometimes get bogged down in this stuff, but you can see if somebody's technically gifted, yes? And you can see if he's athletic. He is both, right? That's not in debate. So then you ask yourself, is he producing to the level of his talent and his athletic ability? And if he's not, you ask yourself why. Is it because he's thick? Is it because he's not being used properly? Is it because he's demotivated? Is it because he's got psychological problems? Whatever it is. I don't know. I think at Roma, he had a perfect environment. He was new to European football. He had a ton of enthusiasm. Now, to me, he seems jaded. I think the first season, I don't think he was as poor in the first season. I think he was just bigged up so much by some people. He started to settle to a very different brand of football in the Premier League. And I think the rest is probably the injury. But I think there's still a player in there if it can come out.
I think the thing is, people thought he was going to just be the same as Bale, and he clearly isn't the same type of player. And what's interesting to me is that on Saturday, he's the one who actually really puts his foot in and actually sets the tempo. He's the one that rushes hard. He's the one that presses. He actually is almost more British than some of those British players in that team in terms of what he was doing for Pochettino. Yeah,
he wasn't doing that before.
And maybe the injuries changed that. Maybe he's had to adjust to his game because he's now more of a midfield player than an actual wide player, because he's not really going to get around. He hasn't got the pace to get around players. But, you know, he's got a good return his goals this season, and he'll probably get his highest, if he carries on, he'll get the highest return. So... Saturday was only his first league start, so that tells you something.
Gav, one for you. The Clásico is only a week away, so who should be more concerned? Is it Real Madrid, who lost again and who might be on the verge of sacking Julen Lopetegui, or Barcelona, who lost Lionel Messi through injury and will be out for 3 weeks?
Well, I think they should both be concerned. I'm going to argue that I think maybe Barcelona should be more concerned here. The reason is, yes, Real Madrid lost. Lopetegui made some odd decisions, leaving Bale and Kroos and Benzema on the bench. But, you know, they did hit the woodwork 3 times. They did create chances. The mood is absolutely rotten. But with Barcelona, if you just look at it, they beat Seville 4-2, and you're great. It's a good team. But they scored those two goals early on were pretty much uniquely down to Messi. Then they got another thing, was a penalty through Luis Suarez on the back of a counterattack, and then Rakitic scored a worldie in the end. In between, they conceded 2 goals to Seville. They conceded also an incredible array of chances. Marc-Andre Ter Stegen put in perhaps the best goalkeeping performance we've seen in Europe this season. This would be a big concern, because now with Messi gone, you, Ernesto, have to figure out how you're going to attack. And on top of that, you also have to sort out what's happening at the back, because frankly, it's simply not good enough right now. So given that I'm not sure Umtiti will be back, I think his options are limited. He's got to work on this in training. And also, whereas Real Madrid play Victoria Pilsen in midweek, Barcelona have a slightly tougher task in Inter Milan. So I'm going to suggest Barca, actually. Right, that's all we've got time for today. Many, many thanks to my excellent guests, regulars from the Times Sports Desk, Bill Edgar, Gary Jacob, and Paul Hurst, and also Lucy Holden, who, of course, reported on perceptions of Ronaldo from Madeira and Turin. Definitely worth your time reading the piece. Now, remember, you can subscribe to the Times and the Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet. It'll cost you just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. I think that's a tremendous deal. Search the Times subscription for more information. We're going to be back on Thursday. And, of course, Natalie Sawyer will be alongside.
The Game is brought to you by the Times. For more information and more podcasts from The Times, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.